I'm Marco Werman. We've reached our goal for the spring fundraiser. The world raised $134,000. That's $134,000 to help pay for the reporting that you depend on each day. It helps us meet the cost of bringing you the news, and it's proof that you value the world's journalism. Thank you for helping us make the world available for free to everyone. If you meant to contribute, there's still time. Go to theworld.org/give. And thank you for supporting the world. Six months of protests in Iraq came to a standstill with the coronavirus. Activists are making good use of the downtime.
We need time to rest, preparing to come back stronger more than before.
Another way to use the extra time in lockdown, bake bread. And people go all in.
Well, to quote Winston Churchill, if you're going through hell, keep going, because that's what happens when you start a sourdough.
Also today, in Norway, global warming is melting the ice, and that's given archaeologists a rare chance to see what's buried below.
That was the greatest moment in my archaeological career. We went into this depression. It was foggy. We couldn't really see anything. And we found a huge object.
A treasure trove revealed. It's all coming up today here on The World. About half of America is reopening for business. As states slowly lift restrictions, everybody seems to have an opinion. Some say it's too soon. Others say there are still too many limitations. Evidently, walking that fine line between public health and a healthy economy is hard. For some guidance, we can look to Europe. At least a dozen countries are easing lockdowns this week. The World's Jason Margolis begins our coverage today, looking at how European plans are unfolding.
In Germany, you can now get a haircut, go to the museum, or visit the zoo. If you pass a temperature screening, you're welcome to pray in church. Kids are going back to school in shifts. In Spain, small businesses are opening up. And in Italy, people are emerging from 2 months under Europe's strictest lockdown, and there was some dancing in the streets. Italian parks are also coming alive, slowly. In Rome, people are returning cautiously.
Spero che le persone abbiano buon senso e insomma.
Chiara De Bonis said, "I hope people use common sense and understand that they still have to act responsibly, and that things should open up slowly."
Spero molto nel senso civico e soprattutto la speranza.
Mirella Morano said she's resting her hopes on people's sense of civic responsibility, so there won't be a surge of new infections sending Romans back into quarantine. Things aren't totally back to normal in Italy, though. Retail shops, schools, and movie theaters remain closed. People are required to stay 6 feet apart in public and wear face masks. And even though restrictions are easing up, officials like Italian parliamentarian Lia Cortapelli are encouraging people to still stay home.
We are inviting people to keep doing smart working. My hometown, which is Milan, in the heart of Lombardy, the town hall has phoned up all the major offices of the city, and apparently 80% of the people will keep working from home.
Still, more than 4 million Italians are heading back into the office or factory. In Milan, Italy's hardest hit city, a light rush hour is returning. The number of people who can enter a subway car is limited. No more cramming in like sardines. Milan's deputy mayor for planning, Pier Francesco Maran, said they're worried people might quickly go back to the old ways. But he said at least so far, they're taking the restrictions seriously.
They are not out too much. They are respecting the rules. So they have masks on face. They keep distances. People, they know it's not over.
That's a point leaders throughout Europe are underscoring. It's not over. French President Emmanuel Macron said the ice is thin. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte urged the public not to squander the progress made reducing the infection rate. Politicians across the continent are reminding the public, if people are too cavalier, they'll have to go right back inside under lockdown. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Italy yesterday co-hosted a global online summit to raise money for coronavirus treatment and vaccine development. More than 30 countries attended and pledged more than $8 billion. The host, EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, called it a defining moment for the global community.
At a time when we are sitting further apart than usual, the world has shown it is standing closer together than ever before.
There were notable absences at the summit: the U.S., China, and Russia. Nicholas Burns is a former career Foreign Service officer who rose to become U.S. Ambassador to NATO and then Under Secretary of State for George W. Bush. He's now at Harvard's Kennedy School and, in full disclosure, an unpaid advisor to the Biden campaign. There's been no explanation, Nick, from Washington as to why it did not participate in this summit. How unusual is it for the U.S. to have been absent at a meeting at this level?
Marco, it is unusual. In fact, you know, this is the first time since 1945, when the United States became the undisputed global power, that we've not tried to lead or even been present in the middle of a major global crisis. And this is an incredible crisis with the pandemic and with the global economic collapse that's underway. And so it's been shocking, I think, for people around the world to see the United States so inert. There's a perception that the United States, with all of our power, our economic power, our scientific and technological power, is focusing just on itself and not focusing on the global campaign, which is, of course, to bring countries together to share information about a vaccine, to decide how that vaccine should be distributed equitably among several billion people, potentially. And I do think it's hurt the perception of the United States as the global leader. And at the same time, as you know, the Chinese government is making a major effort. A lot of it may be insincere, a lot of it propaganda, but a major effort to portray itself as engaged with the rest of the world. So quite a contrast, I think, for countries to look at Washington on the one hand, Beijing on the other.
So besides this kind of disengagement, commentators, and we should also say comedians around the world, are pointing to perceptions of incompetence in the federal government's handling of the crisis. What are you hearing from your diplomatic colleagues around the world?
Well, I mean, I think people are shocked that our infection rate is so high, that our death toll is so high. I think people around the world expected that the United States would be organized, that we would be on top of our game. I think for countries around the world that have made a supreme effort to lock down their societies, Italy and Spain, Germany, South Korea, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, they look at the United States and they see an uncoordinated response, particularly from the federal government. That does hurt our credibility.
You were in the Bush administration, Nick, at the time of Hurricane Katrina. The delayed and ineffective response at the time, as you remember, it shocked the rest of the world. Is this current crisis really that different?
Well, I think it's on a bigger stage. I certainly remember, Marco, I was at the State Department as undersecretary during Katrina, and what was shocking to see so many countries try to come to our aid and deliver humanitarian assistance to the wealthiest country in the world, and to see the failure of our government in New Orleans, frankly, was a really hard thing to take as an American official. This is a much bigger crisis, obviously. The pandemic, theoretically, makes 7.7 billion people, everybody on Earth, less secure, fearful. They're looking for leadership. They're looking for certainty. They're looking for help. And at least they think they're not getting it from the United States. I think the issue that is vexed people the most, perhaps, is the World Health Organization. And let me say, I think the Trump administration is right to have concerns about the performance of the World Health Organization. They covered for China and didn't ask China tough questions early on. But for the Trump administration then to withdraw our funding, it's like withdrawing a funding from the fire department in the middle of a fire. And what it means is that the United States will have less influence in the one organization that is the global clearinghouse on these really critical issues for Americans. There'll be time to reform the World Health Organization, maybe think about a successor organization, but that time is not now. And it's that kind of thing, this impetuous, peremptory, let's withdraw all funding, let's denounce China, let's call it the Wuhan virus. What most of the world is hearing from the White House are these very tough, divisive statements, but not a lot of action to help around the world. And that's not how Americans should act in a crisis like this. We're certainly better than this.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor of the practice of diplomacy at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Nick, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Empty classrooms everywhere. Still, school goes on. That is, if a child has access to the internet. Access to technology is a barrier, even in wealthy nations like the U.S. So just imagine how families living in refugee camps are coping. Suha Tutunji is the academic director of refugee education for the NGO Jusur Lebanon. They provide educational services to Syrian youth. So given that most of the Syrian children live in refugee camps, access to technology like laptops or high-speed internet is pretty limited. So how are you ensuring continuity in education for these kids?
Yes, it is difficult as it is because we do teach in makeshift tents. And this alone is a challenge. So now with COVID-19 and the children being at home, it's even more of a challenge. And as you mentioned, the students do not have any access to any sort of laptops or tablets or what have you. And so the best means was using smartphones because most of our parents have access to a smartphone.
Right. I know the smartphone is one of the crucial tools for all refugees, but aren't the data packages fairly limited? I mean, how do you work around that?
Yes. And this is why when they use WhatsApp, the beauty about WhatsApp is that it uses some of the data bundle that they take for the internet, but it's not as much as they would have if they had been using Zoom or other platforms. And so we've combined short videos or snapshots of worksheets plus voice messages, which don't take up a lot of data. So what happens is that the teacher sends a voice message and they walk them through the book. Let's say, look at page 17. I'm going to read this short paragraph. Now we're going to answer the questions. They do some grammar. Plus, don't forget that in the household, sometimes there is more than one child and there's only one phone. So the fathers need that phone or the mothers to connect to their loved ones in Syria or around the camp. They listen to the news on their phone, so we can't use the phone except for a limited time.
So, Suha, I've heard that the majority of the refugee families you're working with come from rural areas in Syria and that most of the parents are illiterate. Is that accurate? And
yes,
if it is, how hard is it to work with parents keeping the children engaged?
Yes, sadly, I would say more than 77% of the parents are illiterate or have really basic literacy. This was a challenge because they do not prioritize education. It's not a priority for them. And this is where our counselor comes in. And we are also having WhatsApp sessions for the parents just to give them some sort of skills and talk to them about the importance of education.
Mm. So not to be cynical, but if many of these refugee children's education was kind of incomplete before the pandemic,
yes,
how have things changed practically for them in this new reality?
Yes, yes, you're right. I mean, it was incomplete, and some of them will never go to school, especially the older ones. You know, UNICEF has stated it very clearly that if a child does not join school before the age of 10, most likely that child will never go to school. And we do have children who are 10, 11, 12, and I don't think that they weren't in school, and I don't think they will ever go to school. But at least we give them a bit of tools in their hands that they can use. They can read, do a bit of mathematics and arithmetic, just as a tool for them to be able to manage better in life. But we have a lot of children who make it. And if we reach 6, 7, 8%, it's better than 0%.
Suha, you were just in one of these camps today, I understand. Did you see kids studying?
Yes.
Are you hopeful?
Yes, I am hopeful. Because, you know, maybe one good thing came out of this COVID-19 confinement is that because they are at home, a way for time to pass is to read, to do some coloring, to do some fine motor skill activities at home with the beads and beans. It keeps them busy in a productive way. So maybe it might be, you know, a silver lining at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Suha Tutunji is the academic director of refugee education for the NGO Jusur Lebanon. She's been speaking with us from Beirut. Thank you very much, Suha, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Later on the show, when singing from Spanish rooftops turns into a record deal, the Star Maker machinery still works during coronavirus. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. In Venezuela, authorities have arrested a group of mercenaries whom they say were attempting to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Among the group, two American citizens.
El gobierno de los Estados Unidos de Norteamérica está involucrado absoluta y completamente.
President Maduro is blaming the United States and Colombia, a U.S. ally. For more on what's going on, let me turn to the world's Jorge Valencia. Jorge, walk us through what we know at this point.
Venezuelan authorities say that they thwarted this attempt on Sunday, that they stopped a group of men who were attempting to arrive by speedboat to a port that is about 20 miles away from Caracas. And they say that they killed 8 people, and they say that they apprehended 2 Americans. There's this surreal moment in Venezuelan television on Monday in which President Maduro was holding up their passports and their driver's licenses from the state of Texas, and he was saying that they had been sent by the American government.
Yo jugando al Rambo, al héroe, no le habían visto la cara todavía.
President Maduro, being as usual very colorful in his language, said that these 2 men were playing Rambo and that they underestimated how heroic the people of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela are.
And just what do we know about these 2 men and whether or not the U.S. government is involved?
Well, we know that they are former special forces, and we also have a video by a former Green Beret. He uploaded it on Sunday. His name is Jordan Goudreau, and here's what he said.
At 1700 hours, a daring amphibious raid was launched from the border of Colombia deep into the heart of Caracas. Our men are continuing to fight right now. Commander Nieto is with me, is co-located, and Commander Sakay is on the ground now fighting.
These 2 commanders that Goudreau is making reference to are 2 former Venezuelan military. Now, we at The World have not been able to independently corroborate whether everything that Goudreau is saying is true, but the Associated Press has confirmed that he is who he says who he is and that these 2 men who were apprehended are former special forces. Now, nobody else wants to take responsibility for this. That's not the U.S. government, not the Colombian government, and not the Venezuelan opposition, which has very vocally said that they want Maduro to step down.
So mercenaries attempt a coup against President Nicolas Maduro, 2 Americans apprehended. How's this going to play out inside Venezuela, Jorge? How is it playing out?
This is very likely to work in the favor of Nicolas Maduro. And I presented this question to Cynthia Arntzen, who's with the Woodrow Wilson Center, a think tank in Washington, D.C.
My first reaction was that the whole plot was a bit harebrained. The notion that you would land somewhere in Venezuela with a couple dozen men, heavily armed or no, and take on the Venezuelan armed forces just seemed romantic in the extreme and also a little bizarre.
What's likely to happen is that Maduro will use this as part of his ongoing narrative that the United States is working to unseat him and will also allow him to distract from his own government's shortcomings. Extreme poverty, the healthcare system is basically collapsed. Millions of people have fled the country, and not to mention that now the country is facing the coronavirus pandemic. Also, if there were a violent attempt against the president, at the very least, it would result in bloodshed.
More trouble for Venezuela. The World's Jorge Valencia, thanks for this.
Thank you, Marco.
The coronavirus pandemic has pushed the 2020 election to the back burner for many Americans. But for some voters, this fall will be their first time casting a ballot. Today, for our series, Every 30 Seconds, following young Latino voters, we head to California to hear how the coronavirus crisis is impacting one new voter there. Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler of KPBS has our story from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Marlene Herrera. I'm 17 years old, and I'll be voting this year for the general election.
I first met Marlene 3 months ago in February. She's a senior at Scripps Ranch High School in San Diego County. She has her entire life planned out in a notebook that she keeps color-coordinated and marked with sticky notes. In it, she was keeping track of all her college applications.
And I feel like I'm not going crazy, especially during finals week, that I'm just like, where's this, where's that, where's that?
She's the first person in her family to go to college, so it is up to her to figure out how to pay for school.
So it's kind of just a little like, what do I do? Like, what do I put here, what do I put there? And I know my mom like tried helping me a lot with like the application process, like telling me what she could tell me, but there was stuff like she didn't know like, oh wait, what am I supposed to put there?
Marlene wasn't eligible to vote in the March primary because of her age, but she was following the election closely before the pandemic hit. She said that she didn't want to see a repeat of the 2016 presidential election, where her family members were turned off by both parties and their failed promises.
My family members, they kind of, once it came down to the 2 candidates, they kind of were like, well, now we don't want to vote.
In March, she was happy to see Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders win the California primary. Now, 3 months later, Marlene's carefully planned world has been turned upside down by the coronavirus pandemic. No grad night, no prom, no graduation. And Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the race. Marlene is splitting her time between her two parents. For the first month of the quarantine, Marlene and her younger brother stayed with her father, a first-generation Mexican-American. He manages a grocery store and has been working nonstop during the pandemic.
So there's times where it's like he doesn't even want to stay up to eat because he's that tired. It's like the minute he gets home, my brother and I are like, okay, here's your blanket, here's your pillow. He does this thing where he passes on the couch first before he goes to bed.
While her father was at the grocery store, Marlene and her brother were stuck inside. Marlene spent time taking online classes from a nearby community college, and
I picked up gaming, if that counts.
She borrowed her brother's PlayStation 4 and is now meeting up with her friends on Grand Theft Auto online.
We actually did a joke where we were like, we're going to use the pier on the game as our grad night.
Marlene just moved back in with her mother, who spent weeks at home sick with flu-like symptoms. But she never got tested for coronavirus because she's uninsured and worried about costs. Recently, Marlene's mother was also laid off from her job at a law office. Her unemployment claim will help support Marlene and several other family members who live with them. But California's unemployment processing is facing a weeks-long backlog, and the family is still waiting. Faced with inadequate health care and a lack of support from the state, Marlene says she's disappointed to see Sanders go. His platform's focused on expanding these types of programs.
So it's like, even when I found out when he left, I was kind of like, oh, like he's the one who more was on our side about like college-wise, more thinking about like healthcare and stuff compared to the two that we have now. And I'm just kind of like, don't know where I stand. And it's like, even then I didn't know where I stand, but now it's like even worse.
But even with all the uncertainty, Marlene has reasons to celebrate. She got into her top college choices. In the fall, she'll be moving up to the Bay Area to attend San Francisco State. There, she wants to study psychology, so she's closely watching how the country's healthcare industry is responding to the pandemic. Marlene says her family has experienced what happens when healthcare comes at a cost.
You know, I am a low income. You know, I know that feeling. I know the feeling of, like, thank God that, like, my little sister and I have, like, healthcare. But it's like my mom doesn't, you know? So, like, whenever she gets sick, it's like she needs to just fight through it.
With everything going on now, the general election is still far from Marlene's mind.
I'm not happy with either of the candidates, but then again, I haven't really searched into what it is they're proposing, what it is they're doing. Because putting it aside, what I have feelings towards that person is different to what politically they're going to bring into the government, and they've got to see which one's going to be the best option.
She says her mom suggests leaving that part of the ballot empty. But Marlene says it's not going to happen. She's determined to make her vote count in November. For the world, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
News headlines are just ahead. You're listening to The World. Three roommates in Spain under lockdown. They were bored, so they grabbed a guitar, a spatula, some pots and pans, and began writing songs.
Please stay home.
Their online post became a hit, then Sony came calling with a contract. That's still ahead here on The World. For months, Iraqis staged some of the biggest protests in the country's history. They held sit-ins in public spaces and blocked highways to take a stand against unemployment and government corruption. The prime minister resigned, and it seemed like the country was on the verge of major political changes. And then, the coronavirus. So what are the Iraqi protesters up to now? The world's Shirin Jafari reports.
Iraqi protesters wore face masks even before coronavirus. Not that they predicted the pandemic. It was more to protect themselves from tear gas and to avoid being identified by the police. Thousands of Iraqis, mostly young, took part in the demonstrations that began last October. They were frustrated by corruption and mismanagement, high unemployment, and a lack of services. They wanted an overhaul of the Iraqi government. A main gathering point for the protesters was Tahrir Square in Baghdad, the capital.
I spent 6 months in Tahrir Square, losing my apartment, losing my job, losing everything, because I believe the change from this protesters.
21-year-old Ali Amer Al-Mikda posted videos and photos of the protests on social media. In this one, he's gasping from tear gas. But he says he's one of the lucky ones.
I lost a lot of friends in the protests. A lot, like Safa Sarai, like Karar Youssef, like...
More than 600 Iraqis have died in the protests, according to Amnesty International. The human rights organization holds the government security forces responsible. Images of the violence circulating online are chilling. 26-year-old Rasha Albani has been going to the protests in Baghdad.
I had one protester approach me and ask if I could publish a video he took of his friend who had been directly shot in the head with a sniper. And he told me that it was my responsibility to publish it if I could publish it, so that the world could see what was happening. And that's exactly what I did.
Albani, who's British-Iraqi, says she knew going to the demonstrations was dangerous.
But people kept going. There was a lot of resilience and a lot of hope. You know, hope so infinite not even God could break.
The high point for the protesters came in November.
Breaking news from Iraq now. Prime Minister Adil Abdul Mahdi says he will submit his resignation to Parliament amid ongoing
protests. Ousting a prime minister is one thing, but forming a new government has proven to be difficult. Stephen Cook is a Middle East expert with the Council on Foreign Relations.
There have been two other prime minister designates who have been unable to form a government, and now we are on to the third prime minister designate, a gentleman named Mustafa al-Kadhimi.
Cook says Kadhimi has a tough road ahead. As if popular protests weren't enough, he now faces falling oil prices, a pandemic, and a resurging Islamic State. Meanwhile, the U.S., which invaded Iraq in 2003, has lost interest in Iraqi politics, says Cook.
The Trump administration looks at Iraq almost exclusively as a counterterrorism issue and an arena in which to apply maximum pressure on Iran. The administration has had very little to say about the political process that's unfolding in Baghdad and the effort to form an Iraqi government.
Foreign influence, be it from Iran or the U.S., has been a focal point in the protests. Many Iraqis say they've had enough with foreign meddling in their country. Mohammed Al-Wali writes about Iraqi politics and lives in Baghdad. He says the country is currently under lockdown because of the coronavirus, but...
In the past years, Iraq has got used to curfews. We had situations where the security was very bad. People had to stay home for many weeks, actually.
So if the streets are empty, he says, don't assume the protests are over. Ali Al-Mikdam, the young protester, says he's making use of his time in lockdown. He spends his days making calls with human rights groups and coordinating with his fellow protesters. He says this downtime is helpful.
We need time to rest. So coronavirus, it's good time to sit and think. So... this time, it's the time of collecting, preparing to come back stronger more than before after the coronavirus.
After we talk, Mikdam sends me another video. In this one, he's in his kitchen, preparing iftar, the evening meal when Muslims break their fast during Ramadan. And yes, I can report that he too has jumped on the baking bandwagon. Chocolate cake, to be exact, which he later confirmed turned out just perfect. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Uganda has one of the strictest coronavirus lockdowns in Africa, but now President Yoweri Museveni says they've tamed the infection and the country's starting to loosen some of the restrictions. Uganda has 97 reported cases and no deaths. That's in a country of 42 million. The lockdown included a dusk till dawn curfew and a ban on private and public transportation. Police and the army helped enforce it. But those forces have also reportedly beat, shot, and arbitrarily detained people across Uganda. Robina Alambuya says the harsh enforcement has affected especially people with disabilities. She's a disability rights advocate in the city of Jinja near Uganda's capital, Kampala. Alambuya says that from the beginning of the outbreak, authorities did not take into account the needs of people with disabilities.
I think there was a gap right at the start of COVID when the National Task Force was being put in place. There was no representation of disability experts who could guide the plan of how to respond to COVID. So all the teams that were taken out, the security people, every team that was recruited to work in COVID, many of them had limited understanding of the needs, specific needs of people with disabilities. And that's how we ended up. There's another younger man who was beaten in his leg. They showed on media. He was beaten. He had an intellectual disability. He could not understand the way he was communicating with them. They thought maybe it was just because he worked also after curfew time. So it was an issue of awareness.
Yeah, I read a story of a deaf man who was shot because security saw him as disobeying the curfew, which is just shocking. I mean, he had to have his leg amputated. So nearly 15% of Ugandans live with some form of physical disability. That's largely in rural areas. Explain how people with disabilities in those rural villages are actually getting information during the pandemic.
Most of the information has been more on television, radio, online social medias. But the challenge is that people in the rural areas, very few people have TVs in their houses. Very few have radios. Very few even have telephones. If they get the information, then they get it when it has moved through so many people and it has been changed. So sometimes they get not the right information.
Robina, you're also involved at the international level with disability advocacy. How have groups like the UN and the WHO been responding to the risk people with disabilities face during COVID-19?
At the international level, they have tried to put out standards. For example, the UN passed a statement on how people with disabilities and their human rights should be respected during the COVID response. But then I think the challenge is, how is it tailored to our Ugandan situation and how is it being implemented?
Robina, what do you hope can happen when it comes to policy in Uganda? Once the coronavirus has dissipated, what are you hoping that it can do at the policy level when it comes to people with disabilities?
One of the things that we would like to see at the planning of post-COVID, people with disabilities should be well represented.
Are you confident that will happen?
We are holding on hope that it will happen because there has been a lot of voices of people with disabilities demanding for inclusion. At least there are steps that are being taken because members of parliament that represent people with disabilities are now allowed on the national task team. That is the first step. But at the lower levels now, not yet. But at least there is a step. So we are hopeful that now as we are continuing to demand, bringing out voices and bringing out these stories that come, negative stories that have shown that lack of inclusion is very dangerous to all of us, to all citizens. I am hopeful that the post-COVID will be different.
Robina Alambuya is an inclusive disability rights activist in Uganda. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Good to meet you, Robina.
Thank you.
We've been sharing a lot of stories about the power of music during the pandemic, people serenading healthcare workers from balconies, DJs spinning some cool comfort, average Joes turning into overnight sensations on the web with catchy tunes about hand washing. In Spain, three musicians were stuck together in lockdown with a few instruments and kitchen appliances. Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona that their coronavirus songs have sprung them from relative obscurity.
With this reggae-like song urging people to stay home, three roommates in Barcelona became an overnight sensation. The song, with lyrics in English and Catalan, was posted on Instagram on March 15th, just one day after the Spanish government announced a state of emergency and put people on lockdown. Within hours, the song had thousands of views. Now, it's approaching 500,000. And people kept asking for more, says one of the members, Rai Benet.
La gente nos pedía otra y tal.
Benet says he and his two roommates, Klaus Stroink and Guillem Bulto, wrote these songs to pass the time at first. They were already playing separately in other bands. But when the coronavirus crisis hit, they were left without gigs and stuck inside together. Within a week, the trio had a name for their new band, Stay Home Us, as well as their own Instagram and YouTube channels. Now, after 6 weeks and 24 songs in a wide variety of musical genres, they have hundreds of thousands of followers from across the world. And a new record contract with Sony and a sponsorship from a Spanish beer company. The three young guys record all their songs from their balcony, in sunshine or rain. Bonet plays guitar, Bulto plays the drums on a bucket, a box, or various household items, and Stroink adds to the percussion with his hands, a frying pan lid, or even by beating a spatula against a beer bottle. The trio posts an original song roughly every other day, sometimes doing collaborations with other artists through videos. Bulto says they want their lyrics to be socially conscious. Their goal is to use humor to make people reflect. They talk about life under quarantine, missing a loved one, taking care of the community. Even Michael Bublé has covered one of their songs. I just want to see my friends. I wanna walk the street again, but I gotta be patient. So let's enjoy this combination.
Derechos de la canción. Y entonces fue cuando nos dimos cuenta de que no habíamos registrado nada.
Klaus Stroink says their experience with Bublé pushed them to copyright their songs. Lesson learned. It's been an unexpected, fun ride for the guys, but they trade their sudden fame for getting back to life. For them, that means playing live shows again.
Terminar de tocar un tema en los lives que hacemos en Instagram que nadie aplauda, bueno.
Guillaume Bulto says that when they do their weekly Instagram live, it's a strange feeling to finish playing a song and hear nearly no response.
Y se oyen tres palmas, así como...
Sometimes all we can hear are three claps from our neighbors, he says, and it seems like a joke. They say their newfound fame still doesn't feel completely real, since it's all been happening through screens. But with the gradual easing of lockdown in the coming weeks, the three bandmates are already looking towards what will come after.
Pero claro, seguiremos haciendo canciones, cambiaremos.
Bulto says the plan is to continue writing songs as Stay Home Us, though the lyrics will likely change. They already have a sold-out show at a big famous Barcelona venue this July, assuming people can gather in crowds by then. Before that, though, the trio say they want to take a quick break from all the madness and see their friends and families. I really, really miss my mom. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Moya, Spain. I don't wanna wear pajamas.
It's not totally unheard of to find a lost mitten as the winter snow melts. What is unusual? Finding one from 2,000 years ago. That's actually been happening in the Lendbreen Pass in the mountains of central Norway. The melt from unusually warm summers, linked to climate change, has revealed a trove of artifacts. A wool tunic from the Iron Age, a Viking-era mitten, a primitive sled. Lars Pilu is a glacial archaeologist in Norway who's been collecting artifacts from the ice patch. His first trip up there was in 2011, and it was dramatic.
We found a huge piece of cloth, which we didn't know what was, but it looked really old. And that later turned out to be an Iron Age tunic, which was 1,700 years old. And there were other strange finds at the top there. So me and a teammate went ahead to check it out. And that was when we discovered the mountain pass melting out of the ice.
What was that like for you, discovering those things that first trip up there?
That was the greatest moment in my archaeological career. We went into this depression. It was foggy. We couldn't really see anything. And we found a huge object which looked like a giant slingshot, which was in fact part of a sled. We didn't know that at the time. And then the fog sort of lifted. We could see the terrain was littered with artifacts and horse dung.
Wow. As an archaeologist, what do these artifacts tell you?
They reveal that there was actually a pass going through there. Then we can use radiocarbon dating, so we get a glimpse of when it was used and also when the use was most intense.
Yeah, so what is the broad timeline of when this mountain pass was used and who was traveling through it?
Well, we can see that the pass was used from around 1700 years ago, and then its use peaked around 1000 years ago at the end of the Viking Age, and then it declines through the remaining part of the Middle Ages, probably due to a combination of changes in the trade networks there, the Black Death, and more pandemics.
That's an interesting story, especially now with COVID-19. Can you explain the theory around that?
We know with the Black Death that about a half or maybe two-thirds of the Norwegian population died. This was not only Norway, of course, it was the entirety of Europe.
What sort of climate can you assume existed at the time that it was active as a mountain pass for Vikings?
Well, normally you hear about mountain passes getting closed due to glacier advances, so people can't access the passes anymore. But in fact, Lennbrand works a bit different because this is not a glacier with crevasses that people can fall into. It's a large ice patch, which is a more stationary ice body. So people would use this area when there was a lot of snow, because at this altitude, up to 2,000 meters, the terrain is quite rough, and you can't really go through here with your animals and your pack horses.
This is kind of a poignant discovery. Global warming revealed all these artifacts, but it's also your worst enemy, you archaeologists. Won't the warmer air destroy any artifacts that are not now removed from the pass? Is this a race against time for you?
Yes, it is. The strange thing is that the ice works like a kind of a time machine. It preserves the artifacts in a pristine condition. But the moment they get out of the ice and end up on the ground in front of the ice, the clock starts ticking really quickly. So we need to be there to collect the artifacts when they come out. Otherwise, they deteriorate and will be lost.
Lars Pilu is co-director of the Glacier Archaeology Program in Norway's Innlandet County. His research on the mountain pass at Lendbreen is in the April issue of Antiquity. Fascinating discovery. Thank you very much, Lars, for telling us about it.
Great. Thank you.
Check out the photos of that 1,700-year-old tunic and other artifacts, all at theworld.org. Sourdough bread is having a moment, but it's fussy. Instead of store-bought yeast, you need a starter, a mix of flour and water that ferments for a few days. That process means every sourdough loaf is different. Carl de Smet knows this better than anyone. He curates the world's only sourdough library, the Perato Center for Bread Flavor in Saint-Vit, Belgium.
The sourdough tradition has been lost for many, many decades because of the commercial yeast. It's so easy to use. It's fast. It's delivering very consistent bread. But today we see that this revival of sourdough is happening. And it's a good thing that it happens because it is the core of what baking has been for the last 5,000 years. And it's only like the last 150 years that we forgot what it was. And a lot of knowledge has been lost. And what we try to do today is to reinstall that knowledge by studying sourdough and sharing that experience with everybody who is interested in it.
How does the place where those starters come from influence the bread? Like, is it as significant to the taste of the bread as like terroir is to wine?
We have 128 starters. And that gave us like more than 1,100 different species of microorganisms. And so to define which is responsible for what aroma is a bit difficult. But it's true that a sourdough coming from the south of Italy or one coming from the north of Canada is delivering a different flavor. Now, that's due to the microorganisms that are present in there. But also the origin of the flour is playing a role. Eh? What kind of flour is used? In the south of Italy, they use like a durum wheat flour. It's not just one component. It's like the combination of everything. So there's still a lot of stuff to discover. That's the beauty about the library, that we can finally study sourdoughs.
What was your favorite sample to collect? I mean, I assume that this mission of yours for the sourdough library takes you to some pretty far-flung places.
2 years ago, I was in the Yukon, and on the road, someone joined me from Alaska with her sample. And so I collected samples that go back to the Klondike Gold Rush. And to me, that was one of the most amazing things. For me, it was like a kid in the candy store. I could discover many things, and everybody I talked to had a story to tell about sourdough.
So, Carl, what is your advice for people who are just getting started with sourdough? They're watching their starter anxiously. They're not getting that yeasty smell and those bubbles after a couple of... What do you tell them?
Yes. Well, to quote, I think it was Winston Churchill, if you're going through hell, keep going, because that's what happens when you start a sourdough. You mix flour and water, you let it ferment for 24 hours, then you add again flour and water, and you do that for a couple of days. And after 2 to 3 days, the thing starts to stink. And at that moment, many people who are not acquainted with the matter, they say, oh, I screwed up. Oh, I did it wrong. I have to throw it away and I have to restart. But that's the moment that you have to keep on feeding. And you will see that after 5, 6, 7 days, the balance between the lactic acid bacteria and the yeast has happened. And you get something. Yeah, it's bubbly. It's alive. It has a nice flavor. That's my biggest advice. Don't be afraid. When it starts to stink, you just have to continue feeding it and everything is going to be all right.
Carl De Smet is a sourdough librarian at the Perato Center for Bread Flavor in Belgium. Carl, thank you so much for your time and your sourdough expertise. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the heel of the show. Yeah, no one likes the end. Not to worry, though. We'll be right back with you tomorrow. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay strong, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.